This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with a supervisory aeronautical information specialist in the FAA's Aeronautical Information Services visual charting team and talk about aeronautical charts. In the news, the NTSB will decommission the TWA Flight 800 reconstruction at their Virginia Training Center. The Collier Trophy finalists have been announced. We look at each and give you an opportunity to tell us your favorite. Also, Flying Magazine announced their Editor's Choice Awards, and the FAA announced the General Aviation Awards. In other news, the FAA hits Boeing with another fine pursuant to a 2015 agreement, and United Airlines orders 25 new Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. Delta plans to reactivate pilots, and Iceland Air flies a Boeing 767 to Antarctica and back, a 20,000-mile round trip. We'll also tell you about an online auction of ex-military aircraft, some virtual AvGeek events coming up, and a video that explains the checklists the pilots of United Flight 328 likely went through after their number 2 engine failed on their 777. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 643 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hey, everybody. Looking forward to a great show. We're going to talk cartography, which I spent half a day trying to figure out what the word was for map making.
Okay, well, we are going to learn a lot about that. And also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, Max, and everyone who's tuned in here. I got to tell you, I'm excited. I have been a map geek since a very young age. Love maps, so this is going to be a great topic.
Well, also joining us is Hillel. He's a longtime listener and Airplane Geek supporter. Hillel, are you also a map enthusiast?
Absolutely. I was just thinking about having those paper maps, not just the charts for what we're talking about today, but I used to sit there and study maps when I was bored just to figure out how to get around. And Katie can probably relate. I used to work in Crystal City, and the highways in and out of that part of town, just across the river from DC behind National Airport, is just a tangled mess. So I would just sit there and study it just to figure out how to get to work.
Yeah. Maps they're an important part of life. They come in many forms, of course. We're going to talk about some of that with our guest, Katie Murphy. She's a supervisory aeronautical information specialist in the FAA's Aeronautical Information Services visual charting team. Now, Aeronautical Information Services, or AIS, is the FAA's civil aviation authority providing the foundations for flight in the national airspace system. Katie has worked with both VFR and IFR charts for over 17 years, and she calls herself a map geek. Katie, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
You know, we're excited, too, although there's something strange going on. We had two Murphys as guests in last week's episode, and now we have another Murphy this episode. So I'm not sure what's going on with the Murphys, but I do know that the guest next week is not a Murphy. So, Katie, we're going to break
We're taking over the world.
Apparently. All right. So we're looking forward to a great conversation with Katie about what she does there at the FAA and how that affects all of us. But first, of course, we've got some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
First up, we have a press release from the NTSB. TWA Flight 800 reconstruction to be decommissioned. Now, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, leases a facility in Ashburn, Virginia, which it uses as a training center. The TWA Flight 800 reconstruction is housed there in a 30,000-square-foot hangar. It's been there for nearly 20 years, and they use it as a training tool. Now, you may recall that the Boeing 747-100 TWA Flight 800 exploded and crashed into the Atlantic Ocean off Long Island in 1996. It was 12 minutes after taking off from JFK, and all 230 people on board died. Well, the lease at the training center is expiring, and the NTSB has announced its decision to decommission the TWA Flight 800 reconstruction. Now, a number of years ago, some of us from the Airplane Geeks podcast had the honor and the good fortune to be able to tour that reconstruction. David, were you with us on that tour?
I was. I'm kind of heartbroken. I mean, it was, that day was kind of, will live in my memory. I know, I think, Max, you're the same way, forever, because it was, it's kind of hard to imagine, and it was a memorial as well as a training piece, you know, and when you climb up into it and you can see the seats, and all of the seats inside of it were labeled with the passengers, they knew exactly what passenger was sitting where. It was kind of a humbling experience, and really more emotional than you would expect, seeing something that like that. You know, it's kind of a sad thing that they're taking it down, but I mean, it's given 20 years of service to teach the NTSB people how to solve important aircraft incidents.
Yeah, I agree. It was emotional on several levels to be there. The NTSB also gave us a presentation, a full sit-down presentation where they went through the analysis that they had conducted concerning the crash, which was very illuminating. And then to go out into the hangar there and actually see the aircraft. There, of course, have been a lot of conspiracy theories over the years concerning that crash. But when you listen to the explanation from the investigation of all of those different angles that are sometimes cited as, you know, being alternate causes, and then go out and look at the metal, it's very clear. You can see that, you know, the explosion, the force came from inside, not outside. There was no missile exploding outside of the aircraft. It was clearly within that that fuel area. You could see the first bulkhead that that buckled as a result of the fuel vapors igniting. You could see the second bulkhead that it hit and knocked, and then you could actually trace the crack in the fuselage that resulted from that, that, you know, grew across the fuselage. It's a tough, in some ways, it's a tough thing to look at from the perspective of teaching others how to investigate crashes like this, how to do the forensics. This, of course, has been a really valuable tool over the years. Now, there are some posts and comments online you'll see from people saying, well, this should really go in a museum, and people are proposing alternate dispositions of this reconstruction. But it's important to note, and the NTSB does say this in their press release, that when they considered originally using this reconstruction for training purposes, they checked with the families of the victims. And the families of the victims said that, yes, you can use it for that purpose, but we don't want it to become a shrine. We want it to be used for a learning experience and limit it to that. So that precludes any move of this to a museum. So the NTSB, I think, is going to dispose of it, but they are going to scan everything. The technology is a lot different now, and these kind of reconstructions and an analysis can happen in the computer realm after you scan, you know, all the bits and pieces and so forth. So the information that's contained in the reconstruction won't be lost, but the physical reconstruction will depart.
Max, I remember you and David talking about this once years before, and there was a, you know, a key aspect related to the missile theory. David, go ahead and talk about what you didn't see there, which tells you that there wasn't a missile.
There aren't any scorch marks. And like Max referred, when you look at the aircraft up close, you can see that the explosion occurred from the inside out. The way the metal is deteriorated, it does look like it came from an explosion from the inside out. Whereas if it was a missile, you would have seen a penetration point and then the explosion, and that just didn't occur. So there wasn't any indication at all that there was a missile. What is in the presentation is what that people may have seen was parts of the aircraft, molten metal falling from the aircraft. Burning fuel, which looked like the streaks of a missile going up. But clearly, when you see it and you have the NTSB explain it the way they do, you walk out of that building going, there's no way it was a missile. It clearly was exactly what they said it was, which was vapors getting locked in the gas tank and exploding because of a spark from the firewall.
I think you also mentioned the absence of pitting.
Well, there was, right, and there was no explosive residue. If it had been a missile or a bomb or some explosive device, there would have been residue from the explosive, and there was no residue whatsoever on that. If there had been an outside explosion, you would have seen marks to that effect in the skin, of the aircraft pointing inward, and there's none of that. So, sometimes when you hear that the NTSB investigations take a year minimum, sometimes you might wonder, a year, how can it possibly take a year? But when you fully realize the level of detail that they go into, it's almost amazing that it only takes a year, because they look at everything, every witness, and there's an analysis. And in fact, in this case, David, as I recall, now I'd forgotten about this, they actually constructed or took a section of 747 that held the fuel where the explosion occurred, or that would have held the fuel, and blew one up under laboratory conditions to measure the forces and to measure the reactions and things like that, just to confirm the visual evidence. All that takes a lot of time, and that's why when you read an NTSB report, two things are apparent. One is they are very readable. Even though they contain an enormous amount of data, they are written in a fashion that average people can easily understand. And the other thing that you realize is just the level of detail that they've gone into in the investigation. It's really impressive.
And besides that that aircraft 800, which keep in mind, folks, they dredged from the bottom of the Long Island Sound, off of Long Island in the Atlantic Ocean, and rebuilt it. There was also what they colloquially called the petting zoo out in the backyard, which was a bunch of other airframes that were crashed for various reasons and were also learning tools, where they were given the investigators were given the aircraft to figure out exactly with what they see how the crash occurred. And that was one of the ways they learned. So, but like Max said, a lot of that can be done digitally now, but it really was an honor to spend the day there and learn and develop even more of respect. I think Max and I will both attest to that. We have a lot more respect for the NTSB after that day than we did even beforehand. Well, we did, but it's just sort of kind of overwhelming. You know, if you walk into a hangar and you see this 747 that was completely devastated and rebuilt to be as a training tool, it was awesome.
It really was. One final quote, and then we'll move on. I think it's worth mentioning that they connected with representatives of TWA Flight 800 family groups to ensure families of those who perished on TWA Flight 800 that they learned of their decision directly from the NTSB before the public announcement. So I think that's very classy. Okay, moving on. It's time for the Collier Trophy. This is the 2020 edition because it kind of looks back. And the National Aeronautic Association, the NAA, announced the 7 aviation and space achievements that are going to compete for the very prestigious 2020 Robert J. Collier Trophy. Now, our reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, recorded a quick rundown of the nominees. So let's listen to Launchpad.
The National Aeronautics Association has announced its nominees for the coveted Collier Trophy. The list for 2020 represents a very diverse group of projects. In alphabetical order, they are the Bell V-28 Valor. The V-28 Valor is a tilt-rotor aircraft and one of the contenders for the Army's Future Long-Range Assault Aircraft, FLRAA, program to replace the AH-60. Next is the Boeing Confident Traveler Initiative. Boeing stepped up to provide multiple solutions to help minimize the risk of COVID spreading in the cockpit and cabin. The Garmin Autoland System. Autonomy is activated with a single push of a button. The system finds the nearest suitable airport, calculates a flight plan there, avoids terrain, adverse weather. The system then tracks the airplane along its path and lands it on the runway. Reliable Robotics Remotely Operated Aircraft System, ROSE. Reliable Robotics has worked to put automation into aircraft with the ultimate goal of expanding air transportation network through smaller automated aircraft. The company has already achieved remotely piloted flight of a Cessna 172 Skyhawk and a 208 Caravan. Next up is SpaceX Falcon 9 and Dragon 2. A revolution in spaceflight was achieved when SpaceX successfully completed return flights with its Falcon 9 rocket. Last year, the company took another step forward, revolutionizing spaceflight by launching the first crew sent to space by a private company, carried inside SpaceX's Crew Dragon atop a Falcon 9 rocket. After that successful mission, SpaceX followed up with its first operational flight to the International Space Station in November. U.S. Air Force's Green Propellant Infusion mission team. In an effort to fight climate change while continuing space exploration, the Air Force Research Lab at Edwards Air Force Base developed a new low-toxicity propellant for space propulsion systems. And finally, Yates Aerospace Corporation, Silver Arrow. Silver Arrow answers a call for large drone payloads. The electrical delivery system consists of a rectangular box with tandem wing systems, is essentially a drone-guided glider that can carry a surprising 1,400 pounds of supplies for a precision landing. The Silver Arrow has already been deployed in military and humanitarian missions. The Collier Trophy was commissioned in 1910 by aviator, humanitarian, and sportsman Robert J. Collier to inspire aerodynamic industry to reach for higher levels of innovation and excellence.
All right. It's a pretty impressive group of nominees. What do you guys think?
It always is. I mean, the big challenge is just being able to, compare them because they're so different. I pulled up the criteria because I think to really talk about them, it helps to look and see, what the criteria is for the selection. This comes straight from the NAA.aero website, and they say it's going to be awarded annually for the greatest achievement in aeronautics or astronautics in America with respect to, and these are the key criteria, improving the performance, efficiency, and safety of air or space vehicles, the value of which has been thoroughly demonstrated by actual use during the preceding year, which is one thing I really like about the Collier Trophy. It's not about stuff that you say that you're going to do in the future. It's about stuff that you've actually done.
Yeah, and that's why this is the 2020 Collier Trophy, not the 2021 Collier Trophy. There's some great stuff in here going on. And like you're saying, Max, there really is different kinds of projects here. And it's sort of apples and oranges and grapefruits and lemons and a few other things. But I don't know, each year we kind of try to think of who we speculate is likely to take the prize. For me, I don't know. It's tough. I think SpaceX is kind of a favorite because, to me anyway, because here we're talking about commercial orbital class rocket launches. That's pretty significant. The Garmin Autoland, we've talked about that before. That's almost certainly going to end up saving lives at some point. So that's that's pretty significant. I don't know. Hillel, do you have any favorites amongst this group?
I agree with you, Max. My favorite is the SpaceX achievements because of the wow factor. Just watching them over and over again land their rocket boosters on moving platforms in the middle of the ocean. And most of the time, I mean, it was 24 straight landings before this one, something went wrong and they missed it. But they were close enough to actually catch it on the video from the drone ship. Yeah. And so there was a big, I guess, the collective national and international just, oh, wow, that was amazing when the first Dragon 2 went into space with people aboard. And then they turned around and did it again a few months later. Just the turnaround time alone compared to shuttles or anything else, even the Russian rockets, just their reuse and turnaround time is an engineering feat by itself, let alone the reusability of it all. That, to me, has a huge nerdy wow factor that all the other contenders are all worthy. I think that there's just so many firsts with this SpaceX effort and what was able to be achieved by a commercial, albeit government contract as well, but still commercial entity that was not driven by a massive government effort, I think says a lot for what they did.
How about you, David? Do you have a favorite amongst this group?
I got to go with the Garmin Autoland.
Okay.
The potential for it to save lives, I mean, it's going to nullify every 70s movie involving air traffic controllers and someone taking control of an airplane and landing it. Is there a pilot on board? For general aviation, I think that's just an amazing feat, kind of like the F-16 program where they were the loss of control takeover that occurred a couple of years ago that they implemented. So I'm going to go there, though. SpaceX is cool, and some of the other stuff is cool. It's nice to see UAS is getting recognized, but there's something about the Garmin that all of it, that it's kind of a dream come true that, you know, if something happens, something else will take over and land the aircraft. That's just really kind of a cool idea.
And how about you, Max? Have you got a firm guess for who's going to take away the prize?
Of course.
I'm always right.
No, I think I'm only 50%. I think that's my batting average, as I recall. I was definitely wrong last year. I agree with you, David. I think Garmin Autoland, strong contender. I agree with Hillel about SpaceX, pretty darn cool. I'll tell you, as a guy that focuses on GA, the two that I've looked at, you know, the most closely were both Garmin Autoland and then Reliable Robotics Remote Operated Aircraft System. And interestingly, I've had people from those companies on Aviation News Talk for both of them. Episode 173, I interviewed the CEO of Reliable Robotics and actually visited their headquarters. And I was out at Garmin the day they announced Autoland and interviewed people there for episodes 127 and 128. So to me, those just, you know, I'm biased, right? I mean, those, those are the ones I know best. As I compare the two, I think that as much as I love Garmin and Autoland, I think that Reliable Robotics goes kind of a step further. You know, not only are they landing the airplane, but they're doing the whole thing from, you know, start to finish, and they're remotely piloting these vehicles. So if you look at the criteria from a performance, efficiency, and safety standpoint, I think that they really have a lot to say in each of those different categories. I mean, from a safety standpoint, boy, the plane crashes. Guess what? The pilot's, you know, sitting at a control center in Mountain View, California. You know, there's a huge improvement in safety right there. And certainly from efficiency standpoint, I would imagine that you know, airlines and cargo companies are going to be thrilled to have you know, pilots that they don't have to put up overnight at remote locations and things like that. So, and that's why I would give Reliable the edge. But you know, who knows? I mean, this is it's very, very challenging to kind of stack rank things that are just so different.
Yes, yeah, it is. Well, of course, Launchpad Merzari and Micah are two individuals who are never without an opinion, and they have theirs on this topic as well. So let's listen to Launchpad.
Thanks, Max. Before we make our predictions, let's go back and look at last year's. Max Flight and Dave both picked the right guy, but they hedged their bets so much that we're only going to give them half a point each, while Max West and myself were completely shut out. So having said that, for this year, as much as I think the Garmin Autoland system is pretty revolutionary and pretty cool, I think the award's going to go to SpaceX for Falcon 9 and Dragon 2. It's bigger, it's flashier, it's bolder, it represents something that's never been done before. So I will commit myself to the Falcon 9 Dragon 2 team. That's who I think's going to win. And Micah, who do you think's going to win?
You know, Launchpad, I'm with you. Well, more or less. I really think the Garmin Autoland is the unique, most amazing system that's actually working, actually functioning, and something that is brand new, in place, and ready to go now. Most of the other things are in development. Now, SpaceX, yeah, it's working, yeah, it's pretty neat, and it's incredibly sensational, and it takes up all the headlines. I don't know if it's going to win or not. It would be a tie between the two, but if I were choosing, I'm going to choose a Garmin Autoland system. I think that's amazing. And I tell you, if I were a GA pilot, I would want that in my aircraft.
All right. We will ask all of you listening. In fact, what we're going to do is another one of our listener polls. So the question is just simply, of these seven, who would you like to see win the 2020 Collier Trophy? And you can contribute to that poll. Just go to airplanegeeks.com/poll. 643. That's the episode number. P-O-L-L 643. And cast your vote. It's not really a vote, but just your opinion. And as we get closer to the actual award and the decision, we'll sort of reveal how closely the Airplane Geeks listeners matched what the selection committee has determined. Now, that committee is going to meet in June. They're going to meet virtually, as you might expect. And they'll announce the winner after that. And then the formal presentation of the Collier Trophy will take place when, as they put it, when health and safety protocols allow. And so if you're just looking for more information about the Collier Trophy, that's at naa.aero, A-E-R-O. All right. Well, in other aviation awards news, we also have from Flying Magazine their Editor's Choice Awards for 2021. And these awards recognize collaboration in aviation innovation. And one of these three teams will be chosen to receive the Flying Innovation Award. But the Editor's Choice Awards are, first is the Garmin Autoland. And that team includes not only Garmin Aviation, but Piper Aircraft, Cirrus Aircraft, and Dar. The second one is the Sense Thrust Auto Throttle. And that's from Innovative Solutions and Support, along with Pilatus and Textron Aviation. And then the third is the Crew Dragon capsule to the International Space Station. And that's an effort with NASA and SpaceX. So that's the Flying Magazine Editor's Choice Awards for 2021. And then we also have the General Aviation Award recipients for 2020 named. Now, these awards have been given annually for more than 50 years. This is through a partnership program between the FAA and sponsoring organizations from the aviation industry. So the 2020 honorees are first Gary Brossett. That's for the 2020 National FAA Safety Team Representative of the Year. In addition, we also have Dennis Walter, the 2020 Aviation Technician of the Year. And the 2020 National CFI of the Year is Catherine Cavagnaro. And so congratulations to those three. Those winners, they get their awards at AirVenture, at EAA AirVenture in Oshkosh this coming July.
And let me mention Catherine briefly. She's great. I've known her for at least a couple of years. She is a DPE in, Suwanee, Tennessee. She's also, as I recall, a PhD in math. She's a math professor. And we've had her on Aviation News Talk podcast in the past. So she does a lot of writing for AOPA as well.
Yes, she does. I had a feeling that you would know her. All right. Next up, this is a story that Micah sent in. Boeing hit with $6.6 million FAA fine, faces much bigger 787 repair bill. And well, first, a little bit of background. In 2015, Boeing paid a $12 million fine, and they pledged to implement and improve several certification processes to further enhance the airworthiness and continued compliance of all Boeing commercial aircraft products. That settlement agreement resolved multiple pending and potential enforcement cases. Well, what we have going on now is under the agreement back then, Boeing could face up to $24 million in additional penalties over the following 5 years if Boeing failed to implement its obligations. And so that's what we see happening here. It's been 5 years. Earlier agreement in 2015, the issues that revolved around, these things will sound familiar, I think, in given recent events, management oversight and accountability, internal auditing, enhanced supplier management, quality and timeliness of regulatory submissions, specification simplification, first article verification, stampings and other verification records accuracy, corrective action development, implementation and sustainment, and finally reporting obligations. So here we see now the FAA has assessed $5.4 million in deferred civil penalties against Boeing for failing to meet its performance obligations under that 2015 agreement. And Boeing also agreed to pay $1.21 million to settle two pending FAA enforcement cases. So Boeing just can't stay out of the news, it seems.
They can't catch a break either.
Yeah, they could use a break or three, I think, these days.
Well, I mean, their brakes haven't failed yet.
Oh, yeah. But the FAA says Boeing missed some of its improvement targets, and some company managers, this is interesting, did not sufficiently prioritize compliance with FAA regulations.
Boy, you know, if this is going back to 20, we've discovered it's been bad, but now in hindsight, going back since this is from 2015, the culture's really been really lax if this is what's been happening for the last 6 years at this point. It's not surprising they're having the problems they are.
One of my last business trips before I left the Department of Defense was actually to Boeing in Seattle. It was just within a month or two of my departure from the DOD voluntarily, and that was in 97. It's just heartbreaking to see what's happening with the company today compared to what it used to be and what we all believe it to have been. And I won't get into some of the causes behind it, but it's just a very different company.
Well, let's not count them out. I think that they are doing everything they can to recover. I mean, if you look at any business, they struggle at times. And, you know, the good news is I think they are trying to put the the fixes in place. So I think they're going to emerge even stronger. And along those lines, our next story is good news for Boeing.
It is.
United has ordered another 25 Boeing 737 MAX jets to prepare for the recovery. And let's see, I think they also had some other jets that they were moving up here. It says, in addition to the new Boeing order, United says it has moved up delivery of 40 previously ordered MAX aircraft to 2022 and 5 to 2023, meaning it will have 94 new aircraft in its fleet over those 2 years. Already it has 188 orders on the books for the single aisle MAX.
I'm sure that's all for the cost of a free paint job. Meaning all the cancellations that are not going to come back, and Boeing's more than happy to sell them to United and whoever else wants to buy them right now, and they'll probably throw in a paint job for it. Although I wonder if at the rate they need to paint them, they might start flying them with the wrong colors just to get them in the air from the carrier's perspective.
Now, Max, tell us about the Delta and their pilots.
Oh, good news. Delta announces that they're going to reactivate all pilots by October, which is really good news. Looking ahead, they say we're prepared to potentially build back to 2019 levels of flying by the summer of 2023. They never actually furloughed any pilots. They cut a deal that has in the past here essentially reduced pay for some pilots. And now what they're saying is, hey, everybody is going to be coming back by October. So that's really excellent news. And I think there's certainly a number of articles that I have read in the last few weeks where there's a lot of belief that the travel industry is going to, you know, start coming back again fairly rapidly now that vaccinations seem to be, you know, happening, you know, pretty rapidly.
Yeah, Delta's not alone. Just recently, Spirit Airlines also was talking about bringing their entire pilot population back into the fold and starting to retrain them as early as this spring. So they're all looking very optimistically at the the next several months.
Well, and retraining is going to be a big deal. I mean, it's certainly, if you look at, for example, Wind Indicator, which is business jets running off the end of the runway. I read recently that on average, about 25 per year end up doing that. And you would have thought that with the depressed level of flying last year that we would have seen a decrease in that. Even though business jets were flying at about 50% of the rate, they still had about 25 end of runway incidents last year. So I think it just tells us that pilots are not flying as much as they're used to, and the number of the accidents per 100,000 hours appears to be higher.
All right. We also, I guess we could call this an item from our Iceland desk, manned by Max Trescott. We get a lot of Iceland articles from you, Max.
Well, I enjoyed visiting there quite a while ago. And this one I just thought was intriguing because it's all about flying to Antarctica. And, that's pretty unusual. You don't see many stories about flying to Antarctica. So in this particular case, it's an Icelandair 767 with a crew of 20 people, which is headed down to first Cape Town, and then from there on to Troll Research Station in Antarctica. And, you don't see too many commercial airliners actually landing on the ice down there. So that's pretty remarkable. They're saying that it also have some kind of distance records for 767. They're saying that the flight from Iceland to South Africa is a distance of about 7,100 miles. And then it's another 2,700 miles down there to Antarctica. So that sounds like a rather interesting trip. I hope the weather is good for them. I would hate to be landing in Antarctica with a less than perfect weather and certainly less than, perfect runway conditions as well, because the runway is basically, snow and ice that's been kind of flattened out.
And there's some pilot swapping that goes on, right? The pilots that fly from Iceland to South Africa stay in Cape Town to rest, and then another pilot crew flies the round trip between South Africa and Antarctica. And when they come back to Cape Town, the resting pilots get back in the plane and fly it back to Iceland. So, yeah, it's a long journey round trip almost, or I guess a little bit over 20,000 miles.
Yep. And I don't think this article mentions why they're going down there. I've read in other articles that they're taking a number of scientists down there. So that's the reason for the trip.
All right, again, we're speaking with Katie Murphy. She's a Supervisory Aeronautical Information Specialist with the FAA's Aeronautical Information Systems Visual Charting Team. Again, Katie, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Let's kind of baseline our listeners a little bit in terms of the kinds of charts that we're talking about here, what they're used for, who uses them. Give us a little background on that, if you would.
All right. So I have some experience in both VFR charting and IFR charting, actually. VFR charts are obviously the most popular. I think the sectional VFR chart is the number one most downloaded product from our website. So I'm very proud of that. Those, of course, are our 1 to 500,000 scale charts. They cover the United States, Alaska, some of the Caribbean, and of course, Hawaii.
And these are charts that pilots are going to use as one of the navigational tools.
Yeah, absolutely. So VFR charts are, I mean, Max, you can probably get behind this. I mean, they're one of the most powerful tools I think any GA pilot has, right? Not only for planning their flight, but also navigation. We make the paper charts. Well, we make files that end up creating the paper charts, but we also offer an array of digital products that end up in electronic flight bags that I think most GA pilots use these days.
And where does the data for these charts come from? How do you create a chart?
So that's a really good question. Aeronautical Information Services, not only are they the authority for the development of aeronautical charts and products to support aviation, they're also the authoritative government source for collecting, storing, maintaining, and disseminating aeronautical data for the U.S. and its territories. So our Aeronautical Information Services, we actually harvest the data, database it, and then we can apply it per our specifications, our chart specifications to the charts.
And so does this all take place in the digital realm, or you know, do you have people with drafting tables and T-squares and stuff like that still?
I've been in VFR charting or in charting for 17 years, which I don't know how because I'm only 23. So that's just amazing. Yeah. But when I started, I mean, the change of how we have done things from the time I started to today is just absolutely amazing. Technology, I mean, everyone knows technology changes with the blink of an eye, right? And we're constantly making improvements. So when I started, back when I was only 12.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. You know, there were drafting tables and we used a lot of photo processing and, I mean, just all sorts of, there were chemicals involved, believe it or not. And a lot of really amazing cartographic artistry down to, can you imagine someone using a pencil to create shaded relief on the side of a mountain? So that's really cool. And today, you know, because of the advances in technology, we do use a computer aided design program. Currently we use, a program and we can do all of the drafting digitally.
Ah, well, that's good to hear. I was afraid that the answer would be different because sometimes we think of the government, the federal government, being sometimes a little bit slow on the uptake when it comes to technology. So yeah, that's great to hear that, you know, that you're using digital techniques these days. Max, let me ask you, when you're using charts, what kind of changes do you expect to see or sometimes encounter when the chart revision is out? What kinds of things change?
Whoa. So if you look at the traditional 6-month cycle, I think on a typical VFR chart, I've heard there may be as many as 100 changes. And yet when you kind of look at the chart and just kind of glance at it, you don't see any of them immediately, unless it's something really major. Like, for example, the Class Bravo airspace was completely redrawn here in San Francisco a few years ago. And that's a very obvious change. I can remember many, many, many years ago, prior to becoming a flight instructor, not replacing my maps every 6 months. And I remember one time tuning up a VOR and it was like, whoa, where's the VOR? And something as simple as even frequencies of VORs can change. And that doesn't jump right out at you. So I learned the hard way that one really does need to keep their charts updated. And in the days when you had to run off to a store to find them, often you'd have an out-of-date chart. With electronic flight back apps, now it's really easy to always have updated charts so that you don't run into the kind of problems that a very junior max pilot ran into.
Yeah, Katie was smiling when you said you learned your lesson about keeping your charts up to date. When we look at VFR charts, for example, there is a lot of information on those charts. Is there, Katie, is there some criteria that kind of guides you in terms of what information to include on the chart?
Yeah, so I mentioned a little bit earlier, just briefly, but we do kind of have a Bible. And they're the Interagency Air Committee specifications. That's always hard for me to say, by the way. So it's IX specifications. These have been developed by the committee, which is composed of representatives of the Department of Defense and the FAA in preparation of the United States government charts. So there's a process to change the charting specifications, but essentially, like I said, it's our Bible. So it tells us what chart features should have priority, what are used for navigation most frequently, what are the most helpful to pilots. And then, you know, I mean, it gets down to what size font we should use or what size line needs to be used. So they're specific specifications.
Do those change much? Do you get feedback from pilots or others that cause you to, you know, reassess or change those kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. They're constantly changing. There is a process to change those. They have to be obviously vetted, and there needs to be concurrence from several people. But one way, you know, anyone can suggest a change to the specifications is through, we have a biannual meeting. It's every October and April. The public can actually submit an idea. And this is called the Aeronautical Charting Meeting. And through this, you can suggest a change. It will be discussed within this large aviation community. And then, you know, decisions will be made if it's implemented or not. But it's a really cool way for us to do a little bit of outreach with the aviation community. And we really do take suggestions seriously. More often than not, they're good suggestions.
And there's a great example. I'm just pulling up a chart right now. The wind turbine symbol, you know, that probably didn't exist 20 years ago. And yet those are all over the country now and marked on the charts.
So speaking of wind turbines and other things that sort of pop out of the ground, when something goes up, and I guess there must be a way of alerting the FAA to the fact that something is going to go up that's going to be tall or taller than the surrounding terrain that is not normally there or wasn't there before. So whether it's a wind turbine or a tower or even a tall building at the in the protected area of a runway, when or how long would it take to show up in a chart? And at what point would it show up in the chart? For example, the thing might not be finished. It may not be fully constructed. Will it still show up in the chart early, or will it then wait for the thing to actually reach that height, but then the chart's not going to come out for 6 months or whatever it is, 56 days? How does it actually get in there, and how quickly can it get in there if it had to?
Well, the short answer is not quickly, let's be honest. You know, so these things are reported by the builders or the FCC if it's an antenna. And we all know what it's like to get our licenses renewed, right? It's never an easy process. So when, you know, it has to go through all of these channels and it eventually gets to us in the form of data. Now, I will say, and I will remind everyone, I'm sure you guys know, we do show obstructions and then the little UC next to them. So we actually do show obstructions when they're still under construction. And oftentimes we go back, like you mentioned, if they, you know, maybe they were 100 feet taller or 100 feet less, we go in and change that. So we do make an accommodation for that kind of progression through building.
So do the people, the companies, the organizations that plan or construct these kinds of things, towers or tall buildings or whatever, there's a process for them to notify the FAA? Do they know when they need to notify the FAA, or do you have to sometimes kind of chase after that somehow?
You know what? I'm going to be honest here and say that I am so far down that chain of information that I truly do not know.
Okay, no problem.
I can take an IOU and find out some more, though.
All right. Yeah, I'd just be curious to know if that's an issue. Or if you ask the people that construct towers, let's say, do they know what they need to do? They would all say, oh, yes, of course, if it's over this height or under these conditions, and we have to, by requirement or regulation or whatever, report it this way or that way. You know, I'm sure there's a pretty formalized process, and we don't have things sprouting up all over the countryside, you know, willy-nilly, and nobody thinks to think of the aviation impact.
There is one little gotcha in this area, which caused an accident in our area a couple of years ago, and that is that towers under 200 feet don't have to be reported. And so some of the companies that are trying to survey potential locations for future wind turbines are erecting towers that are, say, 197 feet tall to, you know, measure the you know, the airflow in that area to see if they should, you know, build a wind turbine. And I understand that they don't want their competitors to know that they're there, so they keep these towers below 197 so they don't have to be reported. And we had a gentleman who was doing crop dusting on, I believe, Bethel Island, which is here in the San Francisco Bay Area, who hit one of these unmarked towers. So, yeah, people have to be really careful.
Hmm. So is there an easy way to see all the changes that are going to happen to a particular sectional chart? If I wanted to go in and just look at all the changes with the update, is there like a revision history? It's not, obviously it's not on the paper and it's not in the digital version, but if there's a database online where we can say, okay, what were all the changes in this particular sectional for this particular cycle?
You know, you're the second person who's asked me this question this week, actually. So it's kind of interesting. We used to, you guys probably are familiar with the green books or the chart supplements. When we were not in the 56-day charting environment, we issued chart bulletins. These were found at the back of that green book supplement, and they did kind of show the most safety-related changes to every chart every cycle. Now that we are producing the charts every 56 days, we no longer make those chart bulletins because they're on the same cycle as the supplements. So how silly would that be, kind of reiterating the same information that's charted in the back of a supplement? It's just taking up paper, right? So to answer your question, and there is, I'm going to answer it the way I answered the other person who asked me. If I was a jerk, I would respond, which I'm not. I could respond by saying, you know, we have the 28-day subscriber files and eNASR are always available online. So there is a way of getting aeronautical data. However, there is no snapshot of how that data is applied to a VFR chart.
So the instructor answer is you need to become familiar with your charts before every flight. And that's the actual part of the information manual or the FARs that, you know, that's the default answer. It's like, it doesn't matter if there's a revision history, study the chart.
You said it in a not so jerky way. Yours was better than mine.
I'm dying to know one thing about the 56-day cycle. I understand that from a digital standpoint, if you've got electronic flight bag app, you will now see updated VFR charts every 56 days. What if you're buying paper charts? Are the paper charts being printed for VFR sectionals every 56 days now?
Yeah. So this is an interesting process. About 6 years ago, we used to have an in-house printing facility. And where we actually produce, we printed, produced, and distributed all of the charts. for several different reasons, but mostly, you know, just for fiscal reasons, we stopped doing that. What we do now is we have approved print providers. So we, you know, we realize it's our obligation as the federal government, right, to release this information. And if you are an approved print provider, we want to make sure, you know, you can print these files and hopefully make some money off of them, because why wouldn't we help everyone we can? So really, we will be releasing these files every 56 days. The print providers assure us that they are going to be printing them and distributing them like normal. And that is, it's a big change for them. They're private companies, and we wish them the best of luck for sure. We want to, you know, work with them as closely as we can to make sure that everyone who's used to getting the most up-to-date chart still can get that most up-to-date chart.
Besides the printing, are there other functions in this process that are outsourced or performed outside of the FAA?
No, I mean, you know, we are supported by a number of contractors, but they, you know, the contractors do a lot of the compilation work, the chart compilation work. So no, there really isn't anything else I can think of that is outsourced.
Yeah. How big is the team in the visual charting team?
So the visual charting team is roughly, I want to say, about 22 people.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Katie. So how did you become this wonderful cartographer?
Oh, it's such a good question. And I wish I was still a cartographer. So I actually have a degree in geography, a bachelor's of science in geography. And my father was a federal employee. He worked for the National Weather Service. So I kind of always knew, I'm not a very competitive person, I'll be honest. So I kind of always knew I wanted a nice federal job. That's kind of what I went for. You know, I saw all of my friends going, graduating college and going to these super high pressure jobs and having these very anxiety laden interviews. And that just wasn't for me. So I knew civil service was my gig. So I kind of applied for just about everything I could think to apply to. And I got a job offer in Silver Spring, Maryland. So I called my dad and I said, oh, I've got this job. I thought I was going to be rich, you know. I said, it's in Silver Spring, Maryland. He said, Katie, you know that's Washington, D.C., right? I had no idea. So long story short, I have my degree in geography, got very lucky. I knew nothing, absolutely nothing about aviation when I started the job, other than the fact that Bloody Marys taste better at altitude. So it was a steep learning curve, to say the least. And I've loved every day since. I'm grateful. I wake up every morning. I love what I do. I love working for the FAA. So I consider myself a very lucky person.
You wake up every morning and chart your day.
I need a magnet.
David. Yeah, yeah. And how about your peers, Katie? Do they come from a variety of different backgrounds or as well? Or, you know, who are the people that end up doing this kind of work for the FAA?
Yeah, it's such a cool question. So, yes, there really is. It's a spectrum of people. I mean, as you all know, you know, the geographic information systems is I think you can get a degree in GIS now, which was not a thing when I was going to college 5 years ago, but now it is. So a lot of people have degrees in GIS. There's some with degrees in program management. So it really is cool to see how we all come together. And there's a lot of people with private pilot's license who just have a really, you know, their heartstrings are tied to aviation one way or another. So that's kind of cool to see. But we all end up together.
That's interesting. I was going to ask if many of the people there that do have some interest or association with aviation, because I mean, you don't always see that. People can work in an organization. The ultimate customer may be aviation, but the profession itself is not aviation. And so sometimes you just see groups of people that don't have any other real connection to their customers. So it's great that, you know, some people within that organization, you know, have that kind of association.
Are there any problems that need to be solved. Like you're facing a decision or something in the creation of these charts that's like, okay, how do we make this work? Do you have any examples of situations where you can describe? Because Max and David earlier were saying off camera, so to speak, the charts are really confusing and they don't get it. But for those of us that use the charts and we learn to get it, there are extremely functional works of art. And there's a I'm looking at these occasionally or frequently, I should say, and I'm just asking myself, how do they make this work? There have to be conflicts galore that you need to deconflict in order to make the chart functional. What kind of stuff do you face regularly to make it work?
Yeah, so that's a good question. You know, and I mentioned that I'm no longer considered a cartographer because we're aeronautical information specialists. But 2 weeks ago, I was on a Zoom call, of course, with one of the employees in VFR charting. And we were looking at a USGS quad map. I don't know if you guys are familiar with those, but they show contours and, yeah, very detailed topographic maps. And we had to determine the elevation of a valley in this instance using the contour lines. And I thought to myself, you know, it's been a while, but this is the stuff I love, right? You know, you just add or subtract a little bit and, you know, you have to follow those lines around. You really have to pay attention. And we were able to determine what roughly an approximate elevation would be for that spot. So I think that's a good example of still using that kind of cartography mind. And after years of looking at the charts, I mean, Hillel, you mentioned that you look at them a lot. You almost start to get, well, that kind of like, well, this type would look better over there. If it was shifted just a little bit, it would look a little bit better for readability, right? And I think one of the things my peers and I excel at is being super anal retentive or picky when it comes to how things are shown, because it is our job.
Do you also take input on, well, this could be so much easier to read if this was over here and in this color instead? Is there opportunities for that kind of feedback?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And I did want to mention that today. We actually have Aeronautical Information Services has an aeronautical information portal. And it's available if you kind of, I think the link is going to be provided on your all's webpage. And if you kind of dig into that a little bit, you'll find the aeronautical information portal. And oftentimes, this is used just to submit data. So if I were an airport manager, I could kind of say, hey, my runway, I tore up 20 feet on the north end. But it can also be used by you, Hillel. So say you're flying and you see something that's marked as a landmark and it's an old factory and you think, oh, well, that hasn't been there since, you know, 1995. That's the kind of stuff that we love to hear about. We're not going to take it at face value, of course, and we're going to research it through satellite imagery or whatever means we have. But we love hearing from general aviation, the flying public, because those are the things that make our charts better.
I'm dying to know if there have been any kind of interesting goofs that have happened over the years that, you know, maybe made it into print. And I'm thinking, for example, of stamps. There's a classic stamp called the Inverted Jenny in which the airplane was printed upside down. Can you share with us any kind of, you know, odd things where you're like, oh, man, how did that get through?
You know, I honestly can't think of. Nothing comes to mind, to be honest. I wish there was something now.
There's this big circle around DC that's a complete mistake.
Oh, yeah. Let's get rid of that.
I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
So has anybody ever maybe slipped their initials in somewhere just to kind of personalize the chart?
Oh, a little Easter egg.
That is a good one. So that this reminds me. Yes. A long, long time ago. We'll just say a long, long, long time ago. In the chart legend, when there was like a three-letter identifier, just in the legend, not for real navigation or even an airway ident, they might use the compiler or reviewer's initials. So there was a little Easter egg.
Well, there's one here in the San Francisco Bay Area, I think, that still exists to this day. When the VP waypoints, the five-letter visual waypoints, were first begun, and these basically made it easier for pilots to kind of know the local landmarks. And often we had, little flag that showed, here's the refinery, or here's a common reporting point. And then at some point, I'm guessing 20 years ago, they started assigning these GPS fixes so that you could now actually navigate to that. My understanding is that one of the very first fixes was next to San Carlos Airport, the cement plant, and it was VPWFR. Now, I don't know how you get cement plant out of WFR, but I always heard that WFR were the initials of the person who created that point, and that it was one of the first visual points created in the country, and there wasn't a standard for how to name them at that point.
That's a good one.
I think there's a visual point. I don't know if it's a coincidence, but near us, between where Katie and I are, there's a visual waypoint, VPOOP, and it's almost directly over Fort Meade.
Oh. That's
I will say, yeah, I mean, you can't, so there are a lot of them. I think with fixes, you guys, you might be familiar, the airway fixes, there's something, an airway that if you follow the fixes, I think it spells out something like, I thought a putty tat. Yeah,
exactly. That's an instrument approach. So yes, there are a number of instrument approach charts or plates, which have, clever names like that. For example, up in Santa Rosa, they have one with Peanuts names because the creator of the Karmic Strip Peanuts, Charles Schultz, lived in the Santa Rosa area. And so, for example, they are currently reworking the localizer 3-1 approach into Salinas, which has had a number of difficulties with it. And I actually submitted some suggested names, which would come out to be Salad Bowl of the World, because Salinas is known as the Salad Bowl of the World. So we'll see if that makes it in there.
Yeah, and to be fair, VPOOP is not over Fort Meade. It's closer to Annapolis, but it's pretty funny still.
It's still pretty funny. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, these kinds of things are humorous, but just so people listening are clear, who may not be aware, is that the humor doesn't impact the functionality or the safety or anything like that. And I think it's nice that we can find little bits of humor or amusement or something in our lives. So it's not a bad thing at all.
Not to mention those kind of things help you remember what you're supposed to be doing.
Yes.
There are good ways to memorize or memory. There's no reason why you can't have fun. So, Katie, when was the last time you actually used one of your charts?
No.
Meaning, have you... Oh, look at the eyes light up. No, you're not going to get your pilot's license?
No, that's not for me. I'll have my Bloody Marys at altitude, when they say tastes better. I'll sit back there and be just fine.
Good. We definitely don't want you to get your pilot's license. Yeah.
Okay, Katie, one of the things that we talk about quite frequently, of course, is unmanned aircraft and the coming, I don't know if it's a tsunami wave, but just the increase in an unmanned aircraft of all types, little hobby quadcopters on up to urban air mobility and larger aircraft that we may see in the future. Are there implications for the charts with that coming, or is that a conversation that has to take place in the future? Where are we with that?
I think that the whole world of UAS is evolving so quickly, and it has so many facets that affect so much. It's hard to really pin down where the VFR chart's role will be in all of that. I mean, it's my impression that the idea is to integrate these into the National Airspace System, so not to have them as a hazard, but just another flight operation, in which case perhaps in the future we will make we'll add them to our charting specifications and we'll chart them as needed.
All right. One thing I wanted to mention too is, as some of you know, I sort of maintain a list of aviation podcasts. And one of the podcasts that entered into my list, in fact, one that I subscribe to, comes from the FAA. The FAA actually has its own podcast. It's called The Air Up There, and it covers a variety of different topics, but all relating to aviation and airspace, obviously. Did you ever run across that team, Katie, that's producing that podcast?
You know, I don't, unfortunately. The FAA, I think, especially in the most recent years, in the past 5 years, they've done a tremendous job with outreach between podcasts and even being, you know, a presence on Twitter and Instagram. It's really cool to see how a government agency can leverage social media and really use it to inform the public.
That's true. And it's really exciting to see that. I guess if you run into those people, but are you all working from home or do you have to go into the office in these pandemic days?
Right now, my office, you can work from home or you can choose to go into the office. It really just depends. We're treading lightly in these really unsure times. And the last thing I think anyone wants to do is put, you know, ourselves, our family, or any of our peers, coworkers in harm's way. So we're really just trying to be as cautious as we can.
I think that's very wise. All right. Well, Katie, we really appreciate you spending some time with us and in our audience. Fascinating. We like exploring different corners of aviation. It's not always all about piloting an airplane. And so getting a little peek into this aspect of aviation is quite interesting. So you mentioned the Aeronautical Information Portal. Are there any other links or resources, places that we might pass along to our audience, other than the website for the Aeronautical Information Services?
I think that's where to start for sure, and everything from there. If you can explore, but there are a few different ways of reaching out to us. And like I said, we're always happy to hear your experience or, you know, try to make a chart better one way or another. But of course, verify it with our data as much as we can before we chart them.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been awesome.
And by the way, I'm thrilled that we had this conversation because I have something that I want to submit to the portal that's been bugging me for years. We have this really large reservoir that was built 30 years ago, and it's still not on the charts.
So why does a reservoir need to be on the chart?
Well, there are other bodies of water of similar size, and it turns out that this particular one is a reference point that Livermore Tower uses for people who are flying into the area, so...
Yeah, in fact, there's a reservoir on Long Final into my home airport, and it's constantly being referred to as over Loch Raven, so to speak. So it's, you know, you don't have to say 12 miles northwest, just say XYZ over Loch Raven, and they know exactly where to look. So,
yeah. So, Katie, I imagine that when people make those suggestions, those submissions, they're not anonymous, right? You identify yourself, so if there's any questions or anything... you can get back to the person who submitted the proposed change?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's something that I know I pride myself on is I want to get back or at least provide some response to the customers as soon as possible. I know that we all have had those Department of Motor Vehicle experiences where it seems like you're waiting for forever to hear a response or get something completed. So I really try my hardest to at least respond with something one way or another. So no, they are not anonymous. And you know, with the reservoirs, gentlemen, I will say though, that is such a great example. I mean, cause you're pilots, you fly in, you have firsthand working knowledge of this, but keep in mind, and I'll caution everyone out there that on our list of aeronautical features and even topographic features, your reservoir might rank really low. So in some instances, like Hillel, you mentioned you live in this area, the DC metropolitan area, which is really busy, and there's symbols on symbols on symbols, and sometimes we just don't have enough room to chart everything. Hmm. We try.
You know what? I'm wrong. It's been added. It is on the on the chart here. But yeah, exactly.
Good work, Katie. You should take credit for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was me.
But Last I looked, it had not made it onto some of the glass cockpit displays. So maybe that's where the disconnect has occurred.
We don't have to get into this, but I was curious when what really kind of got me rolling on this snowball of discussion was when I was looking at a chart and I noticed that a particular road was on it in some places and not on it in others, and or that a road that was really small had the same symbology as another road that was really big. And so that sort of caught me thinking. It's like, well, what determines when the road goes on, when the road doesn't go on, or the size of the thickness of the road is represented as one thing versus another? And while we don't have to really get into that discussion tonight, it was just kind of where I got the ball rolling in my head. It was like, well, what decides when something does and doesn't go on? And that's how you ended up here.
Well, hey, I appreciate your ball rolling. Thank you guys for having me. It was a good that's a good muse. But, and you know what, I'll go back. It really does boil back down to those interagency air committee specifications. But we do try to show the most valuable navigational features. So that road that you're mentioning, Hillel, you know, that might have been the most populated, busy road back in 1978 when the chart was first created, and maybe just needs someone to call in and say, hey, there's something nearby that would do a lot better at helping us with navigation, and we can look into that.
And can we put Hillel's initials next to that road when we update it?
Yeah, I'll stick that in there. No, in fact, what I thought afterwards was, well, I'm sure that, you know, in a sparsely populated area and it's the only road, then it's going to show up. And then if it enters a more populated area, it's just going to go away because you can't even see it in the trees or in the buildings or whatever. So there's no point. So, I mean, I kind of rationalized it, but it's still the question was out there. So how do these decisions happen?
Yeah, it was a good question. And you're totally right.
And this is not a trivial task. I mean, there is a lot of complicated features and data associated with, you know, mapping the surface of the planet, basically, both things that are man-made and things that aren't. And, I mean, I've come to appreciate this more recently because I've been doing a lot of off-road camping and, off-grid kind of camping on public lands and Forest Service roads and things like that. And I'm looking at data that comes from services like Esri and the topographical maps that you mentioned, Katie, just a whole variety of sources. And all the time you find inconsistencies between them, not major, but sometimes inconsistencies between them or features that are obviously there physically, but not on the map, and just the reverse. The volume of data associated with all these features must make it a daunting task in general. I mean, Katie, do you feel like kind of overwhelmed by it all, or do you feel like you guys have got a pretty good handle on it?
You know what? Almost every day of my career, I have an occasion for bringing up one of our VFR charts and then the satellite imagery overlaid. And a lot of the topographic features, including roads and hydrography and all of that stuff, that was done back, I mean, quite frankly, before I was born. And even now, when I bring that up, the accuracy at which those roads are completely right on, and that lake, you know, the coast of a lake is exactly what it is per satellite imagery, is absolutely stunning to me. So, you know, I think that the people who came before me set something up and made it really easy. And I know that we have some big shoes to fill. So no, it doesn't feel daunting. I like a challenge, and it definitely is one. It takes a certain person. I mentioned, you know, my love for maps. And I think that does take a certain person, someone who favors detail and kind of trying to figure out almost a puzzle. So
yeah, almost a puzzle. That's a really good way to put it. All right.
So speaking of satellite imagery, how many different sources do you use to decide this is what we're going to say is the source? Is there a specific official government source or commercial source, or are you at liberty to even discuss the sources? Or how is it that you You know, because today you don't have to fly a plane over at low altitude to see what's going on. You can just get a satellite image of it, right? You can Google Maps is probably enough, but may not be official enough for you. So, you know, where does that line get drawn, or what's the official source?
Yes, that's a good question. You know what we try to use is whatever source is the most accurate and the most up-to-date. So sometimes that is Google Maps, to be quite frank. Sometimes it is a government source. And we also actually, someone had mentioned or asked me if I ever get to go up in the airplane, Dave, I think it was you. There's a small office that works for the FAA, and they have a lot of other duties, but when they're not flying other missions, they can go up and they kind of fly swaths or like a grid system across a specific part of the United States. And they come back and say, "Hey, bozos, you have this all wrong." And they give us these great markups. So, you know, sometimes it's not satellite imagery, but it's firsthand. And we get to hear from the horse's mouth what needs to be changed.
Yeah, I'm sure that's very valuable at times. Very good. All right. We've got some shout-outs. First from the Australian Frontline Machinery. They're going to hold an aviation auction in March 2021, which, you know, that might sound mildly interesting, except that they're auctioning some demilitarized aircraft and spare parts. These are coming from the Australian Defence Force. So they've got 13 ex-military aircraft, a bunch of spare parts, some things like some cranes, some propeller storage cases, all kinds of things. Some of these planes, they have 8 Pilatus PC-9A roulettes, some other gliders, jet trainer, variety of things like this. So I think this is going to be an online auction. We'll have some links in the show notes, but we also put it in our avgeekfests.com aviation events calendar. So you can find that in there. Also in there at avgeekfest.com, there is the Aircraft Cabin Air International Conference 2021 coming up also in March. That's in there. I think that's also virtual, as I recall. And another one that is virtual coming up March 25th from the New England Air Museum is a webinar in their series. This one is Creating the Future of Vertical Flight, a Sikorsky Innovations Perspective. So you'll find all those there. And again, if you run across any aviation events, which these days means probably mostly virtual events, go on over to avgeekfests.com and submit the event so other people can learn about it. We'd appreciate it. Some listener mail. Tom sent this in. This is a video, a YouTube video from a guy called Captain Joe. Now, I don't know a lot about Captain Joe, but he knows a lot about Boeing 777 aircraft. And he talks about the engine fire that that we had, or the engine failure that we had on the United 777 shortly after takeoff. And he went through listening to the air traffic control recording and talking about what the pilots were most likely going through at the time in the cockpit, especially concerning the checklists and all, which is pretty good. I found it to be a pretty good account. Now, again, I'm not sure of the credentials of Captain Joe. He flies commercially, but at least, you know, this guy watching that video, it seemed like a really good account of what the pilot was going through. I don't know, Max, you've had some conversation about this incident on your podcast, I know.
Yes, the current episode that's out of Aviation News Talk, episode 179, we had a guest on with impeccable credentials. So there is no way to to question the veracity of the information that was included on this episode. And Max, I want to thank you for coming on that show to talk about jet engine failures. We talked, for example, about or rather you talked about differences between contained and uncontained failures and things like that. And as part of that show, I did run through the entire audio that's available for that, and then came up with what I said were the 8 lessons that any pilot could learn from the United 328 engine failure.
So for many listeners of the Airplane Geeks are also listeners of the Airline Pilot Guy, and that podcast has a frequent crew member is Miami Rick, who was a he's still certificated, but he was a first officer in a 777, and he's also an ANP. And as he is wont to do, we'll get into extreme levels of detail. And so he walked through all of the same things that Captain Joe did in the video. And so it all checks out. So if we cross-reference it with someone whom I know is an actual 777 pilot, it's a really cool video to watch with Captain Joe as he walks through it. One tiny little detail Captain Joe didn't bother getting into, which Rick explained, was that most of these checklists are actually right there in their multifunction display. And the display of the checklists are integrated with the cockpit items themselves. So when the item comes up in the checklist, the item on the cockpit lights up in the correct color. So when you toggle it, push it, pull it, whatever, it actually does the checklist for you. So you're not going back and forth between the MFD to actually clear the checks. It happens when you clear the item, and not in every item. Some items do actually have to be cleared by hand, but it was a pretty cool explanation.
Yeah, and that's a brilliant way to design that process. I don't know if that's I wasn't aware of that, until I heard that. And I don't know if that's something that's been around for a long time or if that's, a relatively new way to develop that or to design that. But I think that's, that's a brilliant way to do it. All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up then. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Katie Murphy, the Supervisory Aeronautical Information Specialist in the FAA's Aeronautical Information Services Visual Charting Team. Katie, it's been a blast to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
All right. We're glad you enjoyed it. Are you out there on social media in any kind of capacity that you want to pass along to our audience or not so much?
I'm not so much.
Okay. I just thought I'd give you the opportunity just in case.
Thank you.
Okay. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll find show notes for all of our episodes, links to the stories we talk about, the website that Katie mentioned, a lot of other great information. If you want to go straight to those show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/643. And don't forget the Airplane Geeks listener poll, number 643, where we ask you about who you think you'd like to see win the Collier Trophy this year. That's at airplanegeeks.com/poll643. And, of course, you can always reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Mr. Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
Well, first of all, you can find us on our Slack listener team, and you do that by sending us email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, you can find me the usual social media haunts, which is LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and, of course, that show on Friday mornings called the UAV Digest with Max Flight.
Very good. And Max Trescott, how about you?
You can find me reading maps, as I've been doing most of my life. No, this has been a delight having Katie on the show here to talk about one of my favorite topics. People can find me at Aviation News Talk Podcast, wherever you get podcasts. If you want to shoot me an email, if you have an input for the show, just go out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on listener question at the top, and you can shoot me an email.
Terrific. Hillel, how about you? Where can people follow you?
Well, when Captain Jeff lets me out of his bathroom, which is an inside joke,
yeah,
you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Hillel is H-I-1-1-E-1.
That's clever. It took me a while to figure that out. Well, I mean, to get the keystrokes correct, I kept, spelling instead of replacing with ones.
Well, someone else got there before me, so I'm a little late to the game. I had to settle for
That's how you started doing that.
Yeah.
Ah, brilliant. All right. You can find all the places I hang out by going to 30,000feet.com, all words, spell it out. You'll find all the social media, other places. And I also have there that directory of aviation podcasts. I haven't counted how many are in there, but there's a lot. There are a lot of aviation podcasts. If you know of one that's not in there, there's a way you can contact me through that website and pass that along so I can add it to my directory of aviation podcasts. All right, guys, we'll ask you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast with a guest whose last name isn't Murphy. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.